Across the Pacifica Network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 14, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The Pentagon is planning a new weapon that would blur the distinction between nuclear and conventional weapons. Critics charge it would increase the likelihood the US would deploy weapons of mass destruction in a future battle. Part 2 of our special series looking at the Coca-Cola Corporation in India. And an African-American community battles city contractors in Houston to save their historic school. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United States has opened another military front, this one in Liberia. They're supposed to be providing support to Nigerian soldiers who are doing their part to secure the country for interim President Blah. Blah came to power yesterday after Charles Taylor was forced out by pressure from U.S. officials. Reportedly, rebel leaders in Liberia handed over control of the main port in the country to international forces, the main avenue for food and other essentials in and out of the war-torn nation. And the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution that formally welcomes the month-old Iraqi Governing Council and to establish a mission in the country. Heather Risby has more from the UN.
It was expected that the resolution will be passed without any strong opposition. However, Syria, the only Arab nation on the council which holds the presidency this month, chose to abstain. Despite the overwhelming support for the resolution, the move has been criticized by a number of Arab states. Mikhail Wahbi, the Syrian ambassador, said his country abstained from the vote because it had to represent the views of Arab nations, which believe ending the occupation as soon as possible. Speaking after the vote, U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte described the resolution as an expression of support for the governing council in Iraq and said it endorses the role the U.N. is playing in that country. But a day before the vote, the Bush administration clearly suggested that it had no intention to accept the idea that the U.N. be given a wider role in Iraq, a demand raised by a number of countries. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Later today, the Palestinian security chief is scheduled to meet with his Israeli counterpart, despite a threat by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon that his nation would not move forward in the peace process until the Palestinian Authority starts arresting people they call terrorists, but Palestinians refer to as resistors to the occupation. From Gaza City, Mohammed Galini reports.
The Israeli army has assassinated Mohammed Sidr, the leader of the Islamic Jihad military wing in Hebron. Sidr was killed when the army destroyed the building he took shelter in after it was fired at repeatedly with tank shells and heavy machine guns, according to eyewitnesses. The Israeli army claims Sidr planned one of the most daring attacks against it, in which 12 soldiers were killed in November 2002 in Hebron. Operations such as the assassination of Sidr and the incursion into Askar last Friday are interpreted by Palestinians as attempts by the Israeli government to drag the Palestinian factions into breaking the ceasefire. Late last night, the Israeli army also demolished the home of Islamic Dishat, who carried out a suicide bombing near the Jewish settlement of Ariel on the occupied West Bank. His family rented an apartment in a residential building housing several other families. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mohammed Ghalayini in Gaza.
Violent caste-based clashes have broken out in northern India. Miranda Kennedy reports from New Delhi.
The violence took place in a village in India's northern Uttar Pradesh state, which is known for its brutal caste divisions. It began as a property dispute between the Thakur community and the Dalits, or untouchables, who are the lowest rung on India's ancient Hindu caste system. Their disagreement is pending in court, but yesterday it turned into a fierce battle. Members of the Thakur community arrived on the disputed land and opened fire on the Dalits to try to force them off of the land. At least 7 people were seriously injured, and some reports say as many as 70 were hurt. It is one of the worst incidents of caste violence in recent years in the largely rural and feudal Uttar Pradesh state. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New Delhi.
Some of Verizon's workers are turning to customers for support as contract talks between the phone company and its largest two unions are heading into double overtime. Mitch Perry has more.
The Communication Workers of America wants Verizon subscribers to switch to competitors like AT&T if and when a strike begins. The plan has won the support of many college students, including Maddie Alpenbein of United Students Against Sweatshops, who says she's prepared to organize carrier switches on college campuses unless Verizon improves its relations with workers in its wireless division.
The wireless carrier switch is a solidarity campaign for the one unit of 52 workers who are currently negotiating a contract at Verizon Wireless in support of workers' right to organize.
Contracts covering Verizon employees expired on August 3rd, and nearly 80,000 workers are poised for a walkout. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Mitch Perry.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Reports are emerging that the Pentagon is planning a new device that would blur the distinction between nuclear and conventional weapons. Anti-proliferation activists say the new bomb could start off an arms race and would increase the likelihood that the U.S. would deploy weapons of mass destruction in a future battle. John Hamilton has the story from Washington, D.C.
It may sound like science fiction or even a scene from Dr. Strangelove, but some nuclear scientists warn that the gamma ray bomb could become a reality within decades or even within a few years. The bomb would tap the natural radioactive decay process of unstable nuclear isotopes, which release some gamma rays, only it would speed up the process, releasing massive quantities of the deadly radiation. Gamma rays, like X-rays, can penetrate the human body, and in large doses are lethal.
Well, I think by any reasonable definition of nuclear weapon, this is one, because it involves a specifically triggered change of the state of the nucleus of the weapon material.
Rahul Mahajan is a physicist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. He says the gamma bomb would feed off a high-energy isotope of an element called hafnium-178.
They're saying that 1 gram of this hafnium prepared in the correct state could store more energy than 50 kilograms of TNT.
Opponents of nuclear proliferation say the weapon would blur the distinction between nuclear and conventional weapons. But they add the gamma ray bomb proposal is only the latest in a new generation of weapons under development by the Pentagon, some of which may be deployed in future wars. Jackie Cabasso is with the Western States Legal Foundation, a group that monitors U.S. weapons programs and policies.
What they're trying to do is to develop a continuum of weaponry, merging conventional and nuclear capabilities, or blurring the distinction between nuclear and conventional capabilities, so that there is a military capability available in the arsenal for any possible or potential contingency.
Cabasso warns that continued development into new weapons programs like the gamma radiation bomb will touch off a new arms race as countries facing a future attack by the U.S. develop nuclear arsenals to counter the threat.
All of this points to continuing violation by the United States of the same treaty obligations that it holds other countries to. And with this kind of hypocrisy, it seems inevitable that continued arms racing is going to result, that new arms racing may break out, that other countries are going to walk away from their treaty obligations.
If the gamma radiation bomb is never built, it's more likely to be due to the constraints of physics rather than the result of political will. Dr. M.V. Ramana of Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security thinks the idea might never work.
The science behind trying to store and release in a controlled fashion energy from hafnium-178 are very controversial, and they've been challenged by scientists from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory.
Regardless of the feasibility of the gamma ray bomb, it's clear that research into new, ever more exotic weapons continues. Last week, as the U.S. and Japan marked the anniversary of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, the Bush administration's top nuclear experts gathered in an Omaha Air Force base to discuss and review the U.S.'s nuclear arsenal. The public was not invited. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton.
24,000 workers at Korea's number 2 automaker have gone on strike, demanding an 11% wage increase, plus the right to participate in management decisions, including a preliminary review of new car development and any decisions to lay off workers or move jobs overseas. The request came after Hyundai Motor settled its own labor dispute by allowing its union to have a say in major decisions such as changes in production. Nok Win and Aaron Glantz have more from Seoul. At this Kia Motors factory, located about an hour outside of Seoul, the assembly lines are quiet. Instead, the bustle can be found outside on company grounds. To keep morale up, the workers have organized a sports day. It's hard to believe that they're on strike. The players, all men, are laughing, shouting, and cheering as they kick and spike the ball with their legs over a tennis net. 24,000 factory workers at Kia's three plants in Korea have been striking 4 hours a day since last Friday. The workers want an 11% pay increase, a five-day work week, and the right to participate in management decisions, including the company's plans to scrap cars or develop new lines. Kim Koo-shik makes seatbelts for the Kia Carnival car. He says the workers also want better health care and a safer work environment.
At the Kia plant near Myeon-ni, there are four workers on each assembly line, but they want five workers on each line so they can take a break sometimes.
The union is taking a cue from the Hyundai Motors Union, which last week won a major victory from the company. Hyundai agreed to boost worker wages, to switch to a five-day work week, and to give the workers the unprecedented power to veto decisions on moving operations overseas, outsourcing, and layoffs. Pro-business groups in Korea say giving workers a say in management decisions will drive away South Korean and foreign companies. Choi Wang Choi is with the Korean Employers Federation.
The reason companies are leaving Korea has less to do with the five-day work week. The reason they're leaving is that they see foreign markets like China that have lower wages and less union power. But the five-day work week won't help. It will drive salaries up and production down, and employers don't like that.
Kia estimates the worker job action has cost them more than $150 million. Kia recently reported that its profits for the first half of this year rose nearly 17%, buoyed by exports. Union member Pei Kung Kyu paints Kia Carnival cars. He's 36 years old, is married, and has two kids. He says the most important aspect of the union negotiations for him is having more of a say in car development, because that's key to job security.
In the car cycle, if the company can't sell cars, few people can buy the cars. The management can easily fire workers. This is what I'm concerned about. So even though I may get more money, what's most important for me is the employee stabilization.
It's lunchtime and the strikers still get a meal. The workers file through a line to fill up their trays with food and sit down at long tables to eat. In the kitchen are middle-aged Korean women, preparing and serving food, washing pots and hosing down dirty trays. These women aren't employed by Kia. They work for a food service company that contracts with the automaker. Most of the women are non-union. In another building at the plant, several other temporary contract workers sit down among dozens of boxes of brand new seatbelts. Their job is to test the product, uncoiling, pulling, and snapping together the seatbelts. Another union demand would make these temporary contract workers permanent. Again, Pei Kung-kyu.
The company wants to hire more women because they can hire them more easily than men and pay them less. But I think this kind of job, factory work, is better for men.
The union has very few women members. According to a union spokesman, Kia's irregular workforce also includes college graduates and seniors. The union is threatening to launch a general strike Saturday if its demands aren't met. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Na Gwen with Aaron Glantz in Seoul.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Preservation of an historic African-American neighborhood in Houston hasn't always been the city's first priority. Known as Freedman's Town, the formerly marshy area settled by freed slaves and turned into a center of culture and commerce, was split in half by a freeway in the 1940s. Since then, development efforts by both the city and contractors have whittled away at the area's homes, streets, and even cemeteries. Now the city wants to move forth with a restoration plan that may be as fragile as the decaying school it purports to preserve. From Pacifica Station KPFT, Renee Feltz reports.
In the late 1800s, the original Edmund M. Gregory Institute served as Houston's first school for freed slaves. Another school was built on the same site in 1926. No longer in usable condition, it's now listed on the National Register. Just blocks from a bustling downtown, the school stands on increasingly valuable real estate in the mixed-income community, now characterized by a constant construction of high-priced townhomes alongside deteriorating shotgun shacks. This week, officials with the City of Houston's Building Services Department held a public meeting to announce their plans for a preservation project on the school site. The community's response to the city was less than enthusiastic.
My main concern is that Freedmanstown will be preserved to the extent that it will be recognized as a historical site and a historical area. But I don't see where the integrity of this entire area will be preserved with what I've seen and what I've met with so far. And it disturbs me greatly.
Houston city officials were only able to provide some answers about their restoration plans. Building Services Administrator Issa Dadouche said groundbreaking on the restoration of one of the buildings comprising the historic Gregory Lincoln School could come as early as the end of this year.
Phase one includes the restoration of the 1926 building with approximately 10,000 square foot expansion or addition. The estimated cost for the first phase is $6 million. The scope of services for the existing 1926 building should be limited to archives and gallery display and research / educational purposes. The scope of services for the new addition, I'm referring to the 10,000 square foot addition, would include an auditorium and a multi-purpose area for cultural events.
$6 million in funding for Phase 1 has already been approved by Houston City Council for the design and the construction of the project. But there are no figures yet for operation and maintenance, or for Phase 2 of the project, which would involve renovating another building on the site. The entire site is part of a larger, multi-block plan put forth by the Rutherford B. Yeats Museum Project, a nonprofit organization named after a prominent businessman in Freedmanstown's better days. Currently operating out of the old Yeats House, the project wants preservation of the area to be interactive and broader in scope, even including archaeological digs with university students. The Yeats Museum proposed its own plan for the site, using private funds, and is not excited about what the city wants to do with one of the area's last remaining edifices. Board member Catherine Roberts.
Usually the lowest bidder gets the job, and they may not have the qualifications to do a proper historic restoration job on National Register property. And we saw that with the historic houses in Freedmanstown that the Housing Authority has renovated. They essentially had a demolition group come in and they gutted important architectural features inside the house, windows, doors, wainscoting, wood molding, and trim, which is the heart of the National Register buildings, you know, those features.
Critiques from the community in response to the city's restoration plans include a lack of communication with the Yeats Museum project and a lack of organization as the city tries to move its own project forward. This week, members of the Yeats Museum Project are set to present to the city their plan, over a year in the making with pro bono assistance from local architects. Several lots have already been acquired, along with pledges of monetary support from several private investors who may be driven away by the city's less developed preservation plan. From Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, Pakistan marks 56 years as a nation, yet Pakistanis don't have too much to celebrate. President Bush and the Department of Defense have admired the role Pakistan played in what they call the war against terrorism, yet according to a CENTCOM estimate, Pakistan's economy lost a whopping $20 billion as a result of the war in Afghanistan. And as Masroor Hussein reports from Islamabad, after 5 decades of independence, Pakistan still finds itself among the world's poorest nations, strangled by IMF, World Bank debt servicing, defense expenditure, and intolerance.
No fireworks, no flashlighting on government buildings, no buntings this year. The mood is somber. There is not much reason to celebrate either. Over 200 people died in monsoon floods last month that inundated entire villages in the southern province of Sindh. The U.S. Embassy in Pakistan extended $50,000 towards the relief fund. Homaira Agha teaches Pakistan history in a local school in Rawalpindi, the city where most of the army officers live.
Muslim League politicians in 1947 promised Muslim of subcontinent a better life if they supported the creation of Pakistan. After 50 years, what have they achieved? Poverty, disease, disaster, ignorance, intolerance, martial laws, and even starvation. The worst of all, an unending repression forcing people into submission. Your youth will not get a job. Your houses will be burned down.
Pakistan Muslim League formed government 9 months ago after General Pervez Musharraf announced he was going to bring an end to his three-year-long martial law in the country. Prime Minister Mir Zafarullah Khan Jamali, who belongs to the same Muslim League, urged people to stay united in order to achieve country's destiny.
More than pace of development, Pakistan needs continuation of government policies and coordination in thought and action. Trust me, we will get going in the right direction. We will remove the obstacles in our way and we will get to our destiny. I urge you to stay united. We need solidarity amongst ourselves to achieve our goals.
All governments, democratic or military, have urged the people of Pakistan to stay united. When General Pervez Musharraf staged a military coup in 1999, he accepted that something was seriously wrong with the government. Government leaders before him simply refused to accept the ills of the society, including the brutalization and violence. Asma Jahangir is a renowned human rights activist and founder of Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
You see the amount of violence in Pakistan. And when this whole law and order situation breaks down, the more vulnerable in society are more victimized. Plus, the recourse to justice is less and less as you go lower and lower in any society to people who have less privileges, less and less privileges. And the government is incapable of delivering justice.
One third of Pakistan's 142 million population live below poverty line. The remaining 46% is underfed and survive on crumbs, while 20% gets WHO recommended calories and even more. A huge chunk of Pakistan's budget is chewed up by the defense establishment and debt servicing. Shahjahan Wagarpal is a lecturer with a strong background in political activism.
Millions and billions of dollars had been spent on both the sides, despite the fact that one third of the people in our country, Pakistan, they had been living below the poverty line. And despite the fact that we are spending less than 2% on education and less than 1% in this country for the last 50 years, there has been very meager improvement in the social status.
After 56 years of so-called independence, Pakistan is a society still ruled by oppression. The military oppression, the oppression of the Muslim clergy, the oppression of feudal landowners. The weak obeys the powerful, the younger obeys the elder, and the woman obeys the man. No wonder the society based on irrational hierarchy of obedience is so brutalized in character. For FSRN, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad, Pakistan.
Following FSRN's report yesterday about the levels of pesticides in Coca-Cola and Pepsi in India being higher than the internationally prescribed norms, today Nepal has announced that they too will be testing the cola giants for pesticide content. This is 1 year ago Free Speech Radio News reported about irate farmers protesting against a Coke bottling plant in South India for drying up the groundwater resources of poor and subsistence farmers. Now the same Coke plant has been caught for supplying hazardous poisonous chemicals to farmers in the name of fertilizers. The government-controlled State Pollution Control Board confirmed the presence of poisonous chemicals in the sludge. In this second report of our two-part special series examining Coca-Cola's operations in India, our correspondent Vinod K. Jose reports.
This was a public rally held 1 year ago in front of the Coca-Cola bottling plant in a forest hamlet in southern India. Thousands of angry protesters were shouting slogans demanding the Coca-Cola Corporation to leave the village. The demonstrators complained Coke was extracting 1.5 million liter water every day and drying up sparse groundwater resources. Today, 1 year later, these same villagers have another complaint against the American corporate company. Coke sells a sludge of hazardous chemicals to farmers, saying it is good fertilizer for the crops. And now, the state-owned pollution control laboratory confirmed that the sludge generated by the Coca-Cola bottling plant in Kerala contained a high concentration of lead and cadmium, a carcinogen. Now the villagers demand the government to stop the production and distribution of Coca-Cola in the southern Indian state of Kerala. Kabir C is a leader of the anti-Coke movement in Kerala.
The government should immediately stop the production and the distribution of Coca-Cola.
Even after the State Pollution Control Board discovered the presence of carcinogenic heavy metal in the fertilizer sludge, the government is not considering a ban on the production of Coke. Swaminathan, the chairperson of the People's Resistance Forum, is suspicious of the Indian government's inaction to stop the production of Coke. Swaminathan says multinational corporations in India have a history of bribing local and government officials.
Our leaders in the government have become the aggressors. If the government does not stop the production of Coke, we are even ready to burn ourselves in front of the Coca-Cola factory. Let's see whether that gesture would open the eyes of the government.
Pradeep Sahi is a scientist with Center for Science and Environment, an independent research body which conducted the studies concluding the presence of pesticides in Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Sahi says he doubts Coke scientists were ignorant about the presence of carcinogenic heavy metal in Coke.
It's very difficult for me to believe that they don't know. How cannot they? I mean, they're not stupid people. They are stupid people. They know chemistry. They know physics. I'm sure they know. I think there is a kind of, disrespect. They don't bother, actually. They don't bother.
Even though the Indian government has yet to officially ban Coke and Pepsi sodas, other sectors of Indian society are taking action. Narayanan runs a fast food restaurant in Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. After hearing the studies revealing Coca-Cola and Pepsi to have carcinogens in their products, Narayanan stopped selling Coke.
I had this feeling years back that there is something seriously wrong in Coca-Cola. They don't wash the bottles, and then they fill it again with Coke and supply it to us. We've had numerous complaints from customers. They got nails, teeth, and dirt in their Coca-Cola. In India, business companies get away with any crimes, but they can't do the same in the West. India is still like a colony for them. Now with all these stories, there is no demand for Coca-Cola, and I started selling buttermilk and fruit juice.
Whether it is the pesticides in Coke, or drying up water resources, or selling hazardous sludge, the Coca-Cola Corporation has suffered a 50% market loss in India since last week, according to some of the retailers. For Coca-Cola, India was one of the largest expanding soft drink markets with a sale of 6.5 billion bottles a year. Any damage to this market will surely displease the American corporate giant. I am Vinod K. Jose in India for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at WBAI by Kata Mesta. Headlines editors from WMNF in Tampa, Florida are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abrams. Technical producers at KPFA in Berkeley are Jade Paget-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone. I'm Deepa Fernandes.